planet. In 2015, yet another lobbyist joined the Schuster orbit. Shelley Rubino was not exactly family, but had developed a close, private, and personal relationship with Congressman Schuster. She was, incidentally, in the transportation industry. As a vice president of Airlines for America, an airline industry association, Rubino's job was to represent airline interests to Schuster's committee. At the time of their intimate relationship, Schuster's committee was working on the overhaul of the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, regulations. Decisions were being made about new rules for airline alliances, airline startups, and standards for passenger comfort, all of which would have huge implications for Ms. Rubino's employer. Technically, Schuster did not even violate any congressional ethics rules by becoming intimate with someone who was lobbying his committee. The House Ethics Manual is silent on having a romantic partner who is a lobbyist. Sexual favors from a lobbyist have no monetary value, so the politician is apparently free to receive them. Lobbyists for Airlines for America found yet another way into the Schuster orbit. Chris Brown, vice president for legislative and regulatory policy at Airlines for America, became Congressman Schuster's staff director on the Transportation Committee's Subcommittee on Aviation. Also, Schuster's personal chief of staff is married to the senior vice president of government relations at Airlines for America. Some lobbyists might dispute the ethical concerns of arrangements like those around Schuster. They would say that lobbying value really comes from their expertise on technical and often complex subjects, be it transportation, financial regulations, nuclear engineering, healthcare reform, or patent laws. These lobbyists would argue that they get paid large sums of money because of what they know and how they can help legislators navigate through complex legislation, rather than who they know or happen to be related to. Nothing demonstrates the speciousness of this argument more than a recent academic study published by scholars in the American Economic Review. They decided to test the proposition of knowledge versus relationships in lobbying by asking a very specific question. What happens when a politician switches from one powerful committee to another? Do lobbyists related or connected to the politician keep lobbying on topics related to the old committee, indicating that their knowledge on a subject is what matters? Or do they start lobbying on topics related to the new committee, demonstrating that it is their connection to a powerful politician that matters? They found that while particular expertise was of value to the lobbying enterprise, connections are a scarcer resource, and therefore more valuable. They write, "A lobbyist who is connected to a legislator whose committee assignment includes health care in one Congress is more likely to cover defense-related issues in the next Congress if the legislator he or she is connected to is reassigned to defense in the next Congress." So much of what lobbyists do appears to be predicated on whom they know and have access to, rather than what knowledge or expertise they have. Because access is key, the casual calls and texts, family meals and trips, and intangibles, like love and loyalty, uniquely position such children as politician whisperers. Get these relatives on your team in what is essentially bribery once removed and subject to a W-2, and you shoulder your interests to the front of the line. Chet Lott, the son of Senator Trent Lott of Mississippi, was managing Domino's pizza franchises in Lexington, Kentucky in 2001 when he decided to flip policy instead of pizza. He joined forces with former Congressman Larry Hopkins, a Republican from Kentucky. Together they formed Lott and Hopkins, based in Washington, D.C. and Lexington, Kentucky. Soon their clients included Bell South and a shipbuilding company. The next year, son Chet launched another lobbying firm, Lott and Associates, and represented the National Thoroughbred Racing Association. By 2003, Lott graduated to the Livingston Group, founded by the former Speaker of the House, Congressman Bob Livingston, a Republican from Louisiana. Senator Trent Lott was not the only powerful Republican to see his son settled into a lobbying empire. Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert also saw his son's career take off. Joshua Hastert went from managing a record store called Seven Dead Arson back in Illinois to being a high-paid Washington lobbyist. I realized that doing consulting and government relations on the Hill took up a lot less time than running a record store and brought in a lot more money, he said candidly. Lobbyists cannot legally pay a member of Congress directly. A lobbyist can hire their spouse, but the member must list it on their personal financial disclosure. Adult children are free from these rules of disclosure. Their commercial deals remain invisible. Commercial arrangements made through their children offer political figures plausible deniability. Their fingerprints remain off the money while their influence still guides the flow. Why do most people want to build a family estate anyway? To pass on to one's kids. Congressman William Jefferson, a Louisiana Democrat representing a district in New Orleans, is a cautionary tale of old-school family enrichment. His name conjures up the vivid image of getting caught with $90,000 cash in the freezer. A member of the powerful House Committee on Ways and Means, he had a global estate development plan going involving his family until the FBI raided his home in Washington, D.C., and found the money wrapped in aluminum foil in $10,000 increments and concealed in frozen food containers. What is often forgotten in this famous case is that the frozen funds were part of a convoluted scheme involving a Kentucky internet company named iGate. Congressman Jefferson offered to use his influence to help the fledgling company for a stake in it and a share of its profits. He managed to get iGate on the U.S. General Services Administration, or GSA, list as an approved contractor. And then, with every hint of new sales or investment, Jefferson sought a bigger slice of the pie. One scheme involved securing a contract in Nigeria for iGate in exchange for a larger stake in the company. Jefferson's aim was to give Nigerian Vice President Atiku Abubakar $500,000 as a motivating factor to get iGate the contract. During his trial, Jefferson's defense team argued that he was involved simply because he loved to help Africa. In addition, on a couple of occasions, he met with officials at the U.S. Export-Import Bank to help arrange financing for the deal. In return, investors in iGate wired tens of thousands of dollars to a company called the ANJ Group LLC, a shell company controlled by Jefferson's family, until someone involved in the deal got suspicious and went to the FBI. Jefferson was convicted and sentenced to 13 years, and he and his family had to forfeit more than $470,000. Congressman Jefferson was trying to proxy or offshore his corruption by running it through entities controlled by his family. This would make it defensibly legal graft. Jefferson's mistake was being too direct and bold about it, technically crossing the line between corrupt but legal graft and illegal criminal activity. In this case, a direct bribe. When the Kurdistan Regional Government wanted to get the ear of a powerful member of Congress, they paid by hiring a lobbyist who was romantically involved with that congresswoman, one who would later become her husband. Jack Einwechter was a military escort assigned to Congressman Loretta Sanchez. The California Democrat was a member of two powerful national security committees, the House Armed Services Committee and the House Committee on Homeland Security, giving her a unique say in American national security policy and strategy. Sanchez's husband filed for divorce, and Einwechter left his wife. By 2006, Einwechter had left the military and become a lobbyist at the powerhouse firm Greenberg Traurig. Einwechter and Sanchez became romantically involved and were married in 2011. Many of his clients had business before Sanchez's committees. Over the next several years, he did lobbying work for the arms manufacturer Heckler & Koch, a major Pentagon and Homeland Security contractor, Oregon Arrow, a Department of Defense contractor, and a group of other active or aspiring military contractors, including Protective Group, Thing Magic Incorporated, Realm Wireless, L1 Identity Solutions, and Saab AB. Einwechter was also representing the Kurdistan Regional Government. The KRG had numerous issues of concern before the Armed Services Committee. In September 2007, as a registered foreign agent for the KRG, he arranged for Kurdish officials to meet with Congresswoman Sanchez. She would also join the Kurdish-American Congressional Caucus in the House. Loretta Sanchez and Kurt Weldon may not see eye to eye politically. Sanchez is a liberal Democrat from California, and Weldon, a moderate Republican from Pennsylvania. But the two served together on both the powerful Armed Services and Homeland Security Committees. And, like Sanchez, Weldon would see those close to him profit from his position. Weldon was first elected in 1986 and rose to become the vice chairman of the Armed Services Committee. He had studied Russian and spoke it fluently, so it was fitting that in the chaotic decade that followed the collapse of the Soviet Union, he became an important voice on U.S.-Russia relations. He served as co-chairman of something called the Duma Congress Study Group, an official body set up to foster closer relationships between the U.S. Congress and the Russian legislature, or Duma. He also founded the U.S. Former Soviet Union Energy Caucus to promote energy ties between the two countries. Weldon's daughter Karen had studied education in college and received a master's degree in information systems. She had been working on learning and training programs for the Boeing company, which had a helicopter plant adjacent to her father's congressional district, when she decided on a career change. In 2002, she set up a lobbying shop in suburban Philadelphia called Solutions North America. Her business partner in the venture was Charles P. Sexton, who had served as the finance chairman of her dad's congressional campaigns. Karen Weldon's firm quickly started collecting a profitable slate of clients, many of them from overseas. Solutions North America received a $240,000 contract from the Karic family, wealthy Serbians who had holdings in telecom, banking, and other firms. The Karic family was also linked to the war criminal Slobodan Milosevic. She received that contract after her father had pushed for two members of the family, Dragomir and Bogoljub, to get entry visas from the U.S. State Department. The State Department turned the request down. According to Karen, her father had developed a rapport with the Karic family. Karen Weldon's firm inked a $20,000 per month contract from a Russian aerospace manufacturer that was hoping to sell drones to the U.S. military. At the time, Congressman Weldon was the chairman of the subcommittee with oversight of military acquisitions. According to the U.S. Navy, Weldon pushed a program that would have led to the purchase of the company's saucer-shaped drone. Karen Weldon's firm also received a $500,000 per year contract to push good public relations for a Russian national gas company called Itera International Energy. Itera had been the subject of media reports in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere that alleged the firm had obtained sizable energy assets in a corrupt manner and was conducting business with entities linked to the Russian mob. The controversy was affecting the firm's ability to access capital in the United States. Congressman Weldon rounded up 30 congressional colleagues and held a dinner at the Library of Congress to honor the chairman of Itera. The same day that dinner was held, Weldon introduced a resolution encouraging U.S.-Russian cooperation in developing energy resources. 2 days later, he went to the floor of the House and offered a glowing assessment of Itera. Congressman Weldon was a frequent visitor to the former Soviet bloc because of his policy interest and position on national security committees. When he traveled there, his daughter would often join him. Sometimes her travel costs were paid for by Itera. On one trip, father and daughter met with the president of the Republic of Georgia, who was having a dispute with Itera. Congressman Weldon reportedly helped to resolve it. When asked about his daughter's work and who her clients were, Weldon's office would parse its words carefully. The congressman is generally aware of his daughter's company and the work she does for several of her clients, his office told the media. But the congressman has not discussed the specifics of Solutions North America's agreements with their clients or the nature of their representation. Karen said that her work at the firm was primarily legwork and project management, and that the company was more of a business consultancy than a lobbying firm. The Weldons were the subject of a grand jury investigation, including an FBI raid on both Karen Weldon and Charles P. Sexton. Ultimately, no charges were brought in the case. The Hatches provide yet another example of a political family empire. Senator Orrin Hatch has had a long and distinguished career as a U.S. senator. Elected from the state of Utah first in 1976, he has served as the chairman of three influential committees, the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee, Senate Judiciary Committee, and the Senate Committee on Finance. Hatch's son Scott has been a successful lobbyist for almost two decades, following in his father's wake. Scott Hatch went to junior college and then spent 4 years working in the Senate clerk's office. His job, as he describes it, was to take microfiches back and forth to different committee offices. He then returned to college to finish his degree before joining the lobbying firm Perry, Romani, and DeConcini. The firm was created by his father's longtime Senate aide, Thomas D. Perry. Scott's job at the firm was to answer the telephone, monitor legislation, and watch congressional hearings on television. At the time, he steadfastly refused to lobby. According to Romano Romani, co-founder of the firm, Scott was very, very reluctant to lobby. He was worried about capitalizing on his name. Whatever his initial misgivings, he soon jumped into the game. The firm's clients included large pharmaceutical companies like Schering Plough, which had matters sitting before Senate Hatch's committee. Of particular concern was a piece of legislation that would affect their highly profitable anti-allergy drug Claritin. The firm also lined up construction and manufacturing companies like New Jersey-based GAF Corporation. The company was pushing legislation to deal with asbestos liability in the Senate Judiciary Committee, where Senator Hatch was chairman. But their biggest clients came to be the diet supplement industry, which was facing scrutiny over products like ephedra that were alleged to be linked to severe medical problems. There was a major push in Congress to put supplements under the tighter control of the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, but the industry was vehemently opposed to this federal oversight. Producers of diet supplements were pouring money into the Perry firm where Scott was working. Meanwhile, Senator Hatch was the industry's champion. From his position in the Senate, he played a decisive role in helping the industry fend off restrictive oversight by the Food and Drug Administration. By 2002, Scott Hatch decided to leave Perry, Romani, DeConcini, and Sims, the firm's name was changed in February 2001, and open his own lobbying firm. Inhibitions about lobbying or using his family name were apparently gone now. He joined forces with Jack Martin, a former staffer with his dad who also worked at Perry Romani as a diet supplements lobbyist, and formed Walker, Martin, and Hatch. The firm quickly signed up major clients with matters before Senator Hatch's committee. Bayer Healthcare, Colgate-Palmolive, GlaxoSmithKline, National Nutritional Foods Association, and the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, among others. Senator Hatch did not see this as a problem. In fact, he said at the time that he encouraged his son to start the business. He added, "I would have no qualms talking to Scott about his clients. I wouldn't do anything for him that wasn't right." Scott Hatch reportedly says that he has never personally lobbied for the supplement industry. Both he and his father say he has never lobbied the senator directly. But, of course, he does not need to. That's what the partners in his firm are for. Scott Hatch is not an expert on the legislative process. He has not worked as a congressional staffer, nor does he have any professional background in healthcare or in the other industries that he lobbies for. But he insists that his name does not help him in his busy lobbying and government relations career. "I don't think I get treated any different in the congressional and government offices," he claims. "I don't get a sense that they're saying, 'Oh, this is Senator Hatch's son.' The firm's success is simply a result of the efforts of three hard-working gentlemen." In December 2007, Senator Orrin Hatch found himself having to vote present on an end-of-the-year spending bill. The problem? It contained a $294,000 project for a client of Scott Hatch's lobbying firm. The trouble began when a group in Riverton, Utah, wanted to get federal funds for the Old Dome Meeting Hall renovations project. The request for the federal earmark was made by Senator Hatch himself. In keeping with congressional rules, Hatch had certified when he made the earmark request that no one in his family would benefit from anything in his appropriations request. But of course, the people behind the funding request had retained his son to lobby on their behalf. That put Hatch in a dilemma. Hatch never mentioned the conflict of interest on the Senate floor, later claiming to be unaware the project was included in the appropriations request. He simply had a statement inserted into the congressional record after the fact, saying that it was an unintended and unfortunate oversight. We do not have time or space to recount every tale of legal corruption involving every family member of a politician who is a registered lobbyist. There are just too many, and it has become a standard conceit in the industry. Even beyond the registered lobbyists, there are unfortunately even more family members who operate in the invisible twilight world of government relations, where they do not need to register as lobbyists, even though they are playing largely the same influence game and building their family empires by it. These arrangements work because while House ethics rules ban spouses from lobbying their own spouses' offices, they do not ban children or other family members. The children and other family members may market their access to influence as they like. Such blatant nepotism is not only tolerated on Capitol Hill, but has developed as a highly profitable industry. It would appear that Congress is unwilling to address the problem because they are more interested in building family empires than addressing the egregious ethical problem. We close with two final examples from the Senate. Senator Dick Durbin has represented the state of Illinois in the U.S. Senate since 1997. In 2005, he became the Democratic Party's whip. Durbin's family has done well over the years as lobbyists and in securing government deals. In 1997, shortly after her husband was elected to the U.S. Senate, Loretta Durbin set up a lobbying shop with her friend Alice Phillips. Called Government Affairs Specialists Incorporated, they have collected more than $1 million over the years lobbying public clients in Illinois, even more from a collection of interests including pharma giant Wyeth, Chicago Title Insurance Company, and the Wirtz Corporation. The Durbins insist that he doesn't help her or her clients in Washington. She is registered as a lobbyist in Illinois, not in the nation's capital, but Loretta Durbin's clients have received federal funding that was pushed by her husband, who admits there is an overlap between her clients and firms receiving his help. Although Loretta Durbin insists that she does not lobby the federal government, some of her lobbying contracts suggest otherwise. A lobbying deal with the city of Naperville, Illinois, for example, says the firm would work with state or federal government officials on behalf of the city. Naperville has been blessed with federal grants during the time that Mrs. Durbin represented the city. Naperville's city manager, when asked if Loretta helped win these grants, answered, "I'm sure she did." Durbin's son, Paul Durbin, a lawyer who works in the energy field, also registered as a lobbyist. Paul Durbin's specialty is securing public finance for a variety of infrastructure projects, including renewable energy projects. There are many federal and state programs that make developing renewable energy projects possible, he says. His father sits on the important Subcommittee on Energy and Water Development of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Senator Durbin's nephew, Marty Durbin, has cut a large and profitable path lobbying for an assortment of energy interests. During his uncle's tenure in the Senate, Marty has worked as vice president of the powerful American Petroleum Institute, or API, and then as president of America's Natural Gas Alliance, or ANGA, before finally, in 2015, guiding ANGA to be subsumed into API. According to watchdog groups, ANGA principally represented fracking companies. Fracking, hydraulic fracturing to release natural gas from shale, has been a controversial practice for energy fossil fuels, particularly among Democrats like Dick Durbin. Nephew Marty has used his position and the lobby's money to push their agenda. Senator Durbin has staked out a position on fracking that is much more moderate than that of some of his colleagues. In 2014, he was one of only a few Democrats to initially support the idea of expediting the export of liquid natural gas from the United States to the Ukraine. Marty Durbin has done well. In 2013, he made more than $803,000 from the Gas Association and related organizations and more than $250,000 from API. While the U.S. Senate requires that those who lobby its members disclose if they did so and on what bill, they are not required to report with whom they met. Ethics oversight is strangely silent on this particular detail. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont is the most senior member of the U.S. Senate, having first been elected in 1975. He is an influential figure in the Senate because of his seniority and also because he is the ranking Democrat on the U.S. Senate Committee on the Judiciary. Leahy's daughter, Alicia Jackson, is a lobbyist for the Motion Picture Association of America, or MPAA. According to Senate records, she has lobbied on a host of issues related to the film industry, including intellectual property law. With her dad as the ranking member of the Senate Committee on the Judiciary, there is plenty of overlap. According to lobbying disclosure forms, she lobbied on the Mobile Workforce State Income Tax Simplification Act of 2015, where her father was one of the co-sponsors. In 2015, she sought to influence the nomination of who would be the Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator for the federal government, a position created by her father's legislation in 2008. She has touched on a variety of issues that sit before her father's committee, including cybersecurity, copyright law, and internet rules. We have shown how K Street princelings serve as a ridiculously systematic legal access point for influence. Pay the children of powerful politicians on Capitol Hill to ensure that favors follow, while these politically elite families build their empires at the expense of the American public. Next, we will see how this model replicates on a local level. City machine politicians, who once gained wealth by rigging trash contracts and steering local business to their friends, are now striking bargains with international oligarchs. 7. The Princelings of Chicago. It is not just officials in Washington who cash in with foreign governments. Former Chicago Mayor Richard Daley struck profitable deals with both the Chinese and the Russians. For decades, Chicago has been one of the most tainted cities in America. In 1952, the writer A.J. Liebling quoted a rare, honest alderman who dubbed the Windy City the only completely corrupt city in America. 5 decades later, in the midst of yet another City Hall corruption scandal, the Chicago Tribune itself openly wondered if the town was now, officially, the most corrupt city in America. So it is not surprising that the new corruption methods that are practiced at the highest levels in Washington, D.C. are also practiced in Chicago. The mayors of America's largest cities can wield an enormous amount of power, and power, in a corrupt way of thinking, makes money. Deals with foreign entities channeled through family members work as well by Lake Michigan as they do by the Potomac. Perhaps the best way to illustrate the evolution of corruption in Chicago is by charting the changing practices of one of America's most prominent municipal families, the Daleys. For much of the last half century, the Daley family has run Chicago. A family of Irish immigrants from the city's south side, 2 generations of the Daleys have run City Hall for a combined 45 years. Mayor Richard J. Daley ruled the city from 1955 to 1976 and became a national figure as a powerful urban boss. He was famous for toughness and his administration's corruption scandals. While he was never directly implicated in taking money, his friends, allies, and family did quite well conducting business with the city. He was once asked about city contracts being channeled to his son. "If a man can't put his arms around his sons," he answered, dismayed, "then what kind of world are we living in?" One of those sons, Richard M. Daley, grew up in his father's Chicago and learned the ways of patronage and helping friends and family. He understood the election day tactic, hobo floto voto, shuttling homeless drunks from voting booth to voting booth and paying them 50 cents each time they voted. He was certainly aware of the many financial corruption deals that swirled around city government. The son's skills in the dark arts of dirty politics earned him the nickname Dirty Little Richie from rival factions in the local Democratic Party. 12.5 years after his father died in office, Little Richie assumed the throne and held power on the 5th floor of City Hall longer than his old man. He lasted 22 years, electing to leave in 2011. In the past, former big city mayors like Daley might have cashed in by joining a local law firm or company. But this former mayor of Chicago was also the brother of the White House chief of staff and a friend of President Obama. He had access to more bankable opportunities with foreign oligarchs spanning the globe. The evolution of the Daley family's financial dealings from local to global deals reflects the development of corruption in America in general. The political class, even in our cities, may prefer foreign deals because they are harder to detect and tend to be more bankable. Faced with anti-corruption legislation and transparency measures in the U.S., They seek to broker their power with oligarchs and entities where they can avoid scrutiny. For decades, Chicago has been synonymous with the very real and yet petty corruption of big city America. Insider deals on trash contracts, favorable hiring practices, pension schemes. And while neither Mayor Daley father nor son got rich while in office, family members did well. During Mayor Richard M. Daley's tenure in office, Chicagoans became accustomed to financial deals and scandals involving City Hall and the Daley family and friends. In 2004, an investigation revealed that the city was spending $40 million a year for the use of privately owned trucks that were never used and sat idle. Many of these trucks were owned by felons or mob associates like Nick the Stick Lococo. Mayor Daley's brother John just happened to sell insurance to some of these trucking businesses. The mayor's friends and family made money at taxpayer expense. As one noted book describes it, bribes were paid to officials who gave out the trucking contracts. In the end, the trucking scandal resulted in 49 convictions, 31 of them involved city employees. The mayor and family members were never charged. In 2006, federal prosecutors charged Mayor Daley's patronage chief and top aide Robert Sorich with distributing city contracts to well-connected companies and individuals. The same book states, after weeks of well-publicized testimony, a judge sentenced Sorich to a 46-month prison term. Sorich's trial provided evidence that patronage and fixed contracts were deeply embedded practices within city government and that they probably reached beyond what prosecutors had uncovered. The mayor and family members were never charged. Corruption was systematic and widespread, but the Daleys avoided criminal prosecution. A mayor who was notorious for being hands-on repeatedly claimed ignorance of deals that favored friends and family members. When it emerged that under Mayor Daley a politically connected restaurant was given free natural gas, water, and garbage collection by the city, saving the business more than $5 million a year, the mayor's deposition was subpoenaed by attorneys. He answered, "I don't recall," 139 times. As Mayor Daley ran City Hall, the next generation of princelings, son Patrick and nephew R.J. Vanecco, were making money through its city ties. These two first garnered public attention as teenagers. On a spring weekend in 1992, Patrick and RJ threw a party with friends at the family's vacation home in Grand Beach, Michigan, while his parents were out of town. When some local teenagers crashed the party, Patrick fetched a wall-mounted 20-gauge double-barreled shotgun believed to have once belonged to his late grandfather Richard J. Daley. Vanecco took it and brandished it at the teenagers. Fortunately, the gun was unloaded, but another kid was seriously injured when he was struck in the head by a baseball bat. The local went to the hospital in critical condition. When Mayor Daley returned to Chicago, he held a press conference and sobbed openly about what had happened. "I am very disappointed, as any parent would be, after his son held a party in their home while his parents were away," he explained. "I am more deeply distressed for the welfare of the young man who was injured in this fight." Police investigated the incident, and Patrick ended up pleading guilty to misdemeanor charges of furnishing alcohol to minors and disturbing the peace. He got 6 months probation, 50 hours of community service, and a fine of $1,950. RJ pleaded guilty to aiming a firearm without malice and was fined $2,235. 16 other kids involved in the incident were charged with juvenile and adult offenses. One of Patrick's friends didn't get off so well. He was convicted of aggravated assault in the beating. In December 2004, RJ had an even more serious run-in with the law when he was involved in a skirmish outside a bar. He knocked a man down, killing him. Not only was a judge with mayoral ties assigned to preside over the trial, stories quickly surfaced revealing that investigating officers had misrepresented and covered up evidence because of J.R. Daley's connections. His trial played out in the headlines for weeks, and he was eventually found guilty of involuntary manslaughter and ordered to serve a 60-day jail sentence. From their position of political privilege, Patrick and RJ easily formed lucrative alliances with those doing business with the city. In 2003, likely through a limited liability company, they put $65,000 into acquiring a 4% stake in municipal sewer services, a sewer service company that did business with the city of Chicago, where his father was, of course, the mayor. The next year, Municipal Sewer Services was the beneficiary of a $4 million no-bid contract extension from the city. In the city of Chicago, a company is required to disclose who owns the business if they are doing business with the city. But when MSS filed its disclosure with the city, it never mentioned that Patrick and RJ were part owners. When the Chicago Sun-Times exposed their ownership stake, Mayor Daley again pleaded ignorance as he had in other cases. "I did not know about his involvement in this company," he said about his son. "As an adult, he made that decision. It was a lapse in judgment for him to get involved with this company. I wish he hadn't done it," he said, reading from a prepared statement. He wanted people to understand that Patrick is a very good son. I love him, and Maggie and I are very proud of him. The Inspector General of the City of Chicago and the FBI started investigating in December 2007. Patrick and RJ lawyered up. Municipal Sewer Services folded in April 2008. In January 2011, the president of the company was charged with 3 counts of mail fraud. Contracting as a minority-owned business, he illegally subcontracted the work out to non-minority businesses, including Municipal Sewer Services. Patrick and RJ were not charged in the case. In 2004, Patrick got involved with another company called Concourse Communications that had business with the city of Chicago. The company signed a large fork contract to provide Wi-Fi for the city-owned airports O'Hare and Midway. The contracts were agreed to by then-Mayor Daley's City Aviation Commissioner John Roberson and a panel of city employees. Concourse disclosed its investors to the city, but as with Municipal Sewer, did not mention Patrick's involvement, which occurred via a venture capital fund called Cardinal Growth. On June 27, 2006, largely because of those contracts with Chicago's airports, Concourse was sold at a 33% profit to Boingo Wireless. 3 days after the sale, Patrick got a payment of $164,789. Over the next year and a half, Daley got 5 more payments from Concourse. His total take from the company was $708,999. In June 2011, U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald filed suit on behalf of the Small Business Administration to recover $21.4 million of a $51 million small business loan that was given to the company's owner, Cardinal Growth, but had never been repaid. Cardinal Growth was liquidated. The Daley Princelings also welcomed alliances with overseas entities who were eager to do business in Chicago and needed the right connections. In the early 2000s, Patrick Daley found himself in Moscow, Russia. It is unclear precisely what he was doing there. In August 2001, he met a Russian businessman named Simon Garber. The businessman prided himself on running in Russian political circles. "It's all about who you know," he said in an interview. "It's important to be well-connected. Life is a two-way street." One key ally for Garber was a controversial Russian politician and businessman named Vladimir Slutsker, who introduced him to several high-ranking Kremlin officials. Slutsker is the largest shareholder in the Finvest Group, which owns numerous entities in Russia. Finvest has been under investigation by Russian authorities for a variety of alleged criminal activities, including stock fraud. The investigations have led to the mysterious deaths of 2 law enforcement officials. In April 2005, General Anatoly Trofimov, the former Moscow director of the Federal Security Service, or FSB, was investigating Slutsker. The FSB is the child of the KGB and is generally feared in the country because it can be brutal and aggressive. And with Russian President Vladimir Putin being a former member of the KGB, it has sympathetic figures in the highest of places. But Trofimov was brutally murdered with his wife in a car outside his flat on Klyazminskaya Street. One publication noted that Trofimov was killed by a man with saltatory gait, very similar to the gait of Slutsker's chauffeur. While organized hits are sadly not uncommon in Moscow, the killing of a former senior FSB officer in Putin's Russia is a rare occurrence. When officials investigated Trofimov's murder, Slutsker was the only person who refused to give any testimony to investigators, explaining that his parliamentary status made him immune to criminal prosecution. Months later, in September 2005, another investigator, Nazim Kazakhmedov, from the prosecutor general's office, was shot and killed in a Moscow restaurant. Like Trofimov, he was investigating Slutsker. Simon Garber was interested in getting into the taxi business in Chicago. And a year after he met Patrick Daly in Moscow, he launched his business. In Chicago, you don't just start a taxi business. As the Chicago Sun-Times puts it, in Chicago, City Hall has complete control over cab companies. City officials determine the number of cabs, who can operate them, who can own them, who can drive them, and how much riders pay to ride in them. Garber insists that the mayor's son played no role in launching his new venture. Patrick didn't help me with anything, he said. The only business deals were with a bottle of vodka. But when Garber opened his operation in Chicago, he had a very special guest on hand offering an effusive endorsement. The mayor of Chicago showed up and declared that Garber would dramatically improve taxi service in the city. This is something we have all prayed for many, many years. Garber's business expanded quickly. In June 2003, he controlled 300 taxi medallions. Soon, he had over 800. By 2009, his company was the largest taxi business in Chicago. The Chicago Sun-Times ran a headline, "Russian emigre now Chicago's cab king, a friend of Daly's son." But there was a problem. In 2014, city officials began investigating claims that some of the taxis that the company was using between 2000 and 2010 were actually salvage vehicles, meaning they were cars that had previously been in accidents and were deemed worthless and could not be used as taxis. Garber's company bought salvaged police cars and cleaned the titles before putting them on the streets, which is illegal in Chicago. Investigators found that more than 180 of his vehicles were salvaged. Many believe that Patrick Daly had intervened to help the company with the arrangement. The Daly's pivot to global interests went beyond Patrick's adventures with Russian businessmen. Bill Daly, Mayor Daly's brother, saw how overseas relationships could work to one's commercial benefit. In the 2000s, while his brother was ruling Chicago, Bill was serving as chairman of the Midwest for J.P. Morgan and, beginning in 2007, was the head of corporate social responsibility for the financial giant. In that capacity, he came to play a crucial role in the firm's plans to expand its financial deal-making in China, and the method he used was familiar to the ways of Chicago. Gao Zhu was looking to land a highly coveted and prized position as a 2-year entry-level analyst based out of J.P. Morgan in New York, but he did poorly in his job interviews. According to internal emails obtained by the Wall Street Journal, J.P. Morgan recruiter Daniel Domingue wrote colleagues that Zhu did very, very poorly in interviews. Some MDs said he was the worst BA candidate they had ever seen, and we obviously had to extend him an offer. He screwed up his work visa, and he accidentally sent a sexually explicit email to a human resources employee. According to other internal J.P. Morgan emails, young Gao was seen as immature, irresponsible, and unreliable. But no matter. He was hired and retained by the bank anyway. A company email referred to him as a Bill Daly hire. So why did Bill Daly want to hire Gao Zhu? In a move familiar to anyone following Chicago politics, Daly hired young Zhu because his father was the commerce minister of China. Daly knew Chicago cronyism and corruption and was no doubt aware of the princeling's mentality in China. He simply merged similar corrupt practices from two very different cultures. J.P. Morgan hired dozens of Gao Zhus, setting off a federal investigation concerning the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. In 2011, just as brother Richard Daly was leaving the mayor's office, Bill was moving into the West Wing to serve as President Obama's chief of staff. The Dalys had deep ties to Obama going back more than a dozen years. Michelle Obama was hired to work in Mayor Daly's office by a deputy chief of staff named Valerie Jarrett back when Michelle and Barack Obama were engaged. Jarrett would go on to be Obama's closest confidant in the White House. Bill Daly had been mentor to Obama aide Rahm Emanuel. The other members of Obama's inner circle, including David Axelrod, had long and deep ties to Mayor Daly. In 2008, Bill Daley would play a core role in Obama's transition team, serving as a senior advisor. In November 2006, Bill Daley even played an important role in urging Obama to run for president. Obama drove to David Axelrod's office in River North and shared a private lunch with the J.P. Morgan executive. Obama wanted the Daley blessing on his presidential bid. "Yeah, you gotta run," Bill Daley told Obama. "Why not? What have you got to lose? Can you win? I think you can." Daley also pitched in on fundraising, telling the young senator that he would not have any trouble raising enough money to challenge the Clintons. So in a convergence of princeling activity, as Bill Daley moved to the Obama White House in 2011, recently out-of-office brother Richard Daley was setting up a business with his son Patrick. This was no ordinary business for a former mayor and brother of the White House chief of staff, but rather a global enterprise, with a particular focus on business ties in Russia and China. The business plan was peculiar because these were two disparate markets where the mayor had previously only limited dealings. What the two countries had in common was that both featured corrupt politicians, opaque business cultures, and possibly some Daley connections of reciprocity that made closing big deals easier. The new Daley firm was called Tour Partners. A tour is a wild goat from the Caucasus region of Russia. Why the Irish Americans chose that as a name is unclear. They set up a number of subsidiaries for Tour and placed them in notorious offshore locations. Tour Partners Asia Limited was incorporated in Hong Kong, while Tour Partners Cyprus Limited and Tour Partners Eurasia Limited were incorporated in the island nation of Cyprus. A popular location for Russian oligarchs to set up their business and keep them hidden, Cyprus has some of the most secretive corporate laws in the world. Joining them in these new ventures was Konstantin Koloskov, a Russian investment advisor whom they named as a principal of Tour Partners Eurasia. They also struck a partnership with Makarbek Aushev, a former Russian legislator and Lukoil executive, and named him the director of Tour Eurasia. Aushev had deep ties with the Kremlin at the highest levels. No less than Vladimir Putin had granted him the country's Order of Friendship. Former Mayor Daley also joined the International Advisory Board of the Russian government's Russian Direct Investment Fund, or RDIF, a $10 billion sovereign wealth fund run by the Russian government. RDIF was established in June 2011 to make equity investments, primarily inside Russia itself, with Kremlin money. Daley, of course, had no formal background in finance or private equity. When Russian forces invaded Ukraine in April 2014, the Obama administration slapped sanctions on numerous Russian businesses. The PBS NewsHour noted that RDIF avoided those sanctions for more than a year, citing their deep political ties in the West. Tour Partners' connections were not only with the Russian government, but also with Chinese officials. As mayor, Daley had aggressively courted the Chinese government. He visited the country more than four times as mayor, and Chinese officials visited the Windy City, where they found the environment extremely hospitable. Daley promised that Chicago would be the most China-friendly city, said Chen Duming, then Commerce Minister of China, on one visit. Part of the reason the relationship worked was because Daley never raised any issues related to human rights. Tour Partners brought a Chinese businessman named Pin Ni into the company. Ni runs the American operations of the Wansheng Group, a large Chinese firm. Pin Ni still serves on the advisory board of Tour Partners LLC. For good measure, Wansheng put Richard Daley on the payroll as a consultant. As we will see in the next chapter, the controversial and secretive Wansheng Group also has extensive assets in North Korea. In November 2013, Chinese Vice Premier Liu Yandong hired Daley's firm Tour Partners to handle public relations for her visit to the United States, which included an extended stop in Chicago. During her visit, the Chinese Vice Premier met with Secretary of State John Kerry and Vice President Joe Biden. In March 2012, the Russian government announced that it was creating a transit hub in Ulyanovsk, Russia, that would allow North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, forces to bring non-lethal supplies to NATO's forces in Afghanistan. At the same time, a Chicago-based aircraft maintenance provider, AAR Corp., announced it was building a facility in Ulyanovsk to provide aircraft maintenance capabilities. The move was controversial among many in Russia because Ulyanovsk just happened to be the birthplace of Lenin. The town is actually named after him, his birth name being V.I. Ulyanov. Who was involved in the financing of the deal? Daly's tour partner's Eurasia Fund was listed as a key financier. Vladimir Putin was reportedly behind the deal. U.S. sanctions against Russia in light of the invasion of the Ukraine eventually put American participation in the project on hold. In 2015, Daly's firm was granted permission by the Obama administration to solicit money from foreign investors for real estate projects in the United States. The controversial EB-5 program, administrated by the Department of Homeland Security, allows foreign nationals to invest in projects in the United States in exchange for permanent U.S. resident status. The program has been marred by charges of corruption and favoritism, stemming from a series of EB-5 deals involving many high-profile and politically connected individuals. In the case of tour partners, the EB-5 seemed particularly well-juiced by the Dailies because they were granted permission to raise money for a real estate project Daly himself had approved as mayor. A skyscraper that Magellan Development wanted to build on 28 acres at 195 North Columbus Drive along Lake Michigan. Tour also received permission to solicit financing to help Magellan finance another skyscraper on Lakeshore East, a proposed $900 million 88-story building dubbed Wanda Vista Tower. That project had been approved with great fanfare by Mayor Rahm Emanuel months earlier. When the Chicago Sun-Times drew attention to the deal, Tour bizarrely claimed they were not involved in the Vista project, even though they applied to finance one of the sites on which it is being built. We contacted Tour partners and former Mayor Daly to ask about these deals. They did not respond to multiple queries. We have seen how American princelings and their families profit from these arrangements, whether their families hold power in the White House or City Hall. But why do foreign actors play ball with the American princelings? What's in it for them? Let's look at one Chinese company that has profited from its relationships with some of the players we have already seen. 8. The Haesan Youth Copper Mine of North Korea. Foreign corporations with ethically sketchy business practices hire American politicians and their family members to shield themselves from scrutiny by the federal government. Political ties can help them overcome sanctions for even some of the worst human rights practices. It is easy to understand why U.S. politicians like to build secret empires. Funds are hard to track and rewards enormous for their families. But to understand why foreign corporations and governments are willing to invest in such politicians or their families, it helps to look at these activities from a foreign entity's perspective. To that end, we will look at a foreign corporation with a troubling profile acquiring assets in the United States and around the world, including North Korea. In such a company's view and experience, investing in politicians, their families, and friends brings high-yield returns. Wan Sheng owns auto parts companies, real estate, and energy companies, and has a global presence including a large footprint in the United States. It has also collected powerful political friends on both sides of the aisle, by putting them and their family members on the payroll. Along the way, it has skated past federal regulations and avoided sanctions for doing business in North Korea that have plagued other companies. It offers a powerful illustration of how politically connected firms make members of the American political class wealthy while getting special treatment in the United States. Wan Sheng is a Chinese conglomerate in the coastal city of Hangzhou, along the East China Sea that began as a commune and brigade enterprise, Shudui Chiye, in 1969, a reflection of Mao's great cultural revolution. Lu Guanqi, the son of farmers, built the company first by collecting scrap metal and then by maintaining and forging agricultural machinery. Next came manufacturing universal joints for cars. Wan Sheng actually means universal in Chinese. Before his death in 2017, Lu Guanqi was the chairman of a powerful conglomerate and is one of China's wealthiest men. Early photos show Mr. Liu meeting with foreign customers in a Mao jacket. Later, he appeared in beautiful suits with American presidents, other politicians, and their family members. Liu Guanqi and his company succeeded thanks to his tight bond with the Chinese government. Liu began cultivating close ties to Chinese Communist Party officials in Zhejiang Province, his home base, from the company's earliest days. He benefited from his strong personal link with a particular local party secretary named Zhu Bingshang to keep the business going. By 1985, the Chinese Communist Party, or CCP, named him an excellent party cadre. By 1987, he was elected to a local CCP executive post. Until his death, Liu sat on the powerful and exclusive Chinese National People's Congress, a legislative body that meets every 5 years in Beijing, where prearranged political appointments to top party offices are put to a vote and formally sanctioned. His company also benefits from what the Boston Globe calls close business ties with many government-owned enterprises, including one of the nation's largest grid operators, State Grid. Liu Weiding, Liu's only son, became president of the company in 1994. He was first admitted to the party as an alternate member of the Central Committee of the Communist Youth League around 2000, gaining full membership in 2007. CCP officials are littered throughout the top ranks of Wan Shang's management team. As Yang Yunlu, general manager of the work office of the party committee, explained to Canada's National Post, enterprises operating on Chinese soil are under the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party. The party is an advanced organization and represents the excellent staff and citizens of the society. We will try to gather all the advanced members as the core of the sub-branch of the party and make them contribute to the success of the enterprise. Liu credited the Chinese government for his success. His wealth at the time of his death was estimated to be more than $5 billion. Wan Shang's foray into the United States began in the 1980s, when they established American headquarters in Chicago. The Chinese conglomerate has vast holdings in the United States in real estate, manufacturing, energy, and other businesses. Some of these include solar facilities that are dependent on U.S. government grants and aid. Along the way, Wan Shang has carefully chosen to do deals with America's most powerful political figures and put their friends and family members on the payroll. In 1999, just as then-Texas Governor George W. Bush was riding high in the Republican presidential primary, Wan Shang signed up his uncle, Prescott Bush, as a paid advisor to the company. The Chinese Xinhua News Agency described him as the company's economic counselor. Liu explained that inviting Prescott Bush to be the counselor will help expand Wan Shang's operations overseas. The company's spokesman added, "He doesn't have a set of responsibilities. When we need his help, we will contact him. He has many friends. Even though he may not be involved in the same field as we are, he can go to his friends for help in resolving our issues." Once George W. Bush moved to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Uncle Prescott stayed on the payroll. Similarly, when Barack Obama rolled into the White House in January 2009, Wan Shang benefited from relationships with many of his Chicago colleagues and friends. Wan Shang had worked closely with Chicago Mayor Richard M. Daley for years. In the spring of 2011, at the end of his tenure as mayor, Daley took a trip to China and visited the headquarters of the Wan Shang Group. He was greeted by Liu Guanqi, and as he exited the car, he walked a long red carpet into the company's electric automobile division. Shortly after he left the mayor's office, Daley was added to the Wan Shang payroll, but has not disclosed how much he made. As noted in the previous chapter, Mayor Daley had the right connections in the Obama White House. His brother Bill served as Obama's White House chief of staff. Several senior Obama officials, and even First Lady Michelle Obama, had worked for or with him. Wan Shang's close ties in Washington were noted by the Chinese government's China Daily. Wan Shang America's achievement has been associated with the U.S. government's support and encouragement, they noted. Certainly, government officials like to encourage investments and court businesses accordingly, but Wan Shang's level of access was unusual. No less than Vice President Joe Biden invited Liu to visit several cities in the United States, including Washington, D.C., to explore investment opportunities. Wensheng also allied with the family of close Obama friend Penny Pritzker, Obama's finance chair and a longtime supporter who later became Commerce Secretary. Pritzker had family members who struck partnerships with Wensheng, including a $1 billion real estate deal. Talk to any of the politicians or their family members forming alliances with Wensheng, and you are likely to hear that it is just like any other company. But in fact, this